It's time for Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. With nationally recognized nature writer and award-winning horticulture and nature expert, Bill Finch. Bill shares his knowledge of conservation, natural history, and gardening. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with your personal garden and nature consultant. Here's Bill Finch on FM Talk 106.5.
Hey, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. It's a very good time to think about what Alabama was like 200, 300 years ago. I've been thinking about that a lot lately for a variety of reasons, one of which it was 250th anniversary of our current country. It was not a country 250 years ago here in Alabama. There was no nation, essentially, that had firm control over anything like Alabama at that time. It's an odd time. We could talk a little bit about that. But the other reason I'm thinking about it is because the Mobile Airport Authority asked me to think about the landscape around the new airport. And and thinking about it sort of reminds me of all of the difficulties we have imagining what a Gulf Coast landscape would be like and should be like and could be like. You know, one of the, they came to me with a plan that looked like something you would buy at Home Depot. And I'll have to say, I'm this obnoxious person, and I have to say this. So much of what we see in our yards now is about what we can buy at Home Depot. And I guess we're kind of stuck. We stuck ourselves with that. Because our Lowe's, our Walmart, any of those chains, that's where we're getting our material. And it's a very limited material. And that means that an airport that looks like Home Depot in Mobile is going to look like an airport that looks like Home Depot in Ohio, that looks like an airport that looks like Home Depot in California. You see what I'm saying? They're all the same. And somehow people wanted a distinctive look for this Mobile airport, which is a interesting idea, maybe even a great idea, an idea that says, oh, well, you're here in a different sort of place. You're here in a new place that's not like the place you came from. And it's an interesting place. And there's all those reasons for thinking about it. And because it's going to be obvious that Mobile is not Ohio after a little while. And so you want to just say, yeah, it's not Ohio, but look at this. Take a look at this. Isn't this cool? Isn't this neat? Isn't this, Ohio can't do this. So I'm thinking about it. And you can help me on the show today, if you will, by thinking about what does a Mobile garden look like? What does a Mobile landscape look like? What does a Gulf Coast landscape look like? What does an Alabama landscape look like? It's going to look like very different things in Birmingham and Huntsville and Montgomery. And Mobile, it's going to look very different in all those places. But what does it look like? And do we choose a landscape that we have now, which is be cautious, because what we're seeing now is Home Depot landscapes everywhere. And we don't have the great variety of plants that we used to have that were available for Mobile or Montgomery or Birmingham or Huntsville, because we only have what Home Depot gave us. So we can't just say, oh yeah, I remember what life was like 20 years ago. and it all looked like what I got off the shelf at Home Depot. Because that's not what we're going for. We're saying what's really distinctive about the history of gardening and landscape and natural landscape in Mobile that we can use to promote here. And so I've been thinking about it really hard. You should too. And we have to go beyond what's just available now. And one of the great difficulties, as all of you will discover, is if you can find, there's so many plants. There's so many beautiful plants, so many edible plants, so many fruiting plants, so many nice ground covers, so many nice things that we could be planting, trees that would grow well in our climate, exceptionally well, except they're not available because we've decided only Home Depot can. We're going to let Home Depot tell us what it is that we want to plant. So what do we, how do we do that? How do we get around that? And it's hard. And I have made life hard. Oh boy. I know, for the landscape firms that have been hired to deal with the airport. And I apologize to them as I apologize to you. But what I'm really apologizing for is the miserable state of our plant world right now. And we all should be working to solve that mystery and that problem, I should say. And we'll be talking about that as well. But let's think about what would this landscape look like. And I have to go back. Oh man, this is a long story. What was it like? What was this landscape at the airport like? You know, they've got this airport. The airport's going to be down there right on the bay because, you know, 15 years from now, you're going to have a new highway that goes from Baldwin County into Mobile. You don't mind waiting, do you? And so it's, you know, it's, they want it right there. And that's good. That's fine. It's already an airport there. They're going to build on it and they're going to make it better. And what was that like? How do we, let me tell you what that landscape was like. It was probably pitcher plant bogs. I don't know if you've ever seen a pitcher plant bog, but they're absolutely stunning. They're incredible. They take your breath away. You just don't even believe places like Splinter Hill are possible until you see them. Incredible. The number of wildflowers, the number of lilies, the number of orchids, the number of plants you've never heard of. Sometimes 50 species of plants per square yard. Species. I'm not talking about individual plants. I'm talking about different species. Incredible diversity in those pitcher plant bogs. And they were very open and they had very few trees. And that's what that area was more than likely like. It wasn't live oaks, except maybe right along the edge of the bay in a few places where there was shell hash. It wasn't that. There were probably pines, maybe slash pine, maybe longleaf. There may have been ponds with pond cypress, not the bald cypress in the Delta, but probably pond cypress, and fires would have been fairly frequent there. And you know what? When people weren't looking, the bison were probably creeping back into those areas. That's, you know, even around 1700, we've got plenty of evidence of bison in Alabama. And the jaguars were here, more than likely, in those areas too. I don't think very few people encountered them because jaguars are pretty quiet, pretty secretive, and don't really have much business with people. But there was clear evidence of jaguars there along the Gulf Coast, maybe Jaguarundi as well. Another kind of cat, and really a very interesting and very different environment. We can't reproduce that anymore. Not there. I wish we could recreate those pitcher plant bogs because they're one of the most stunning things in the whole world. And every pitcher plant bog we've got to hold on to, and we should try to restore them. But you can't do that at the airport. It's not going to work. The soils have changed. We changed the soils. We didn't want them to be bogs. We didn't want them to be swamps. So we brought in fill dirt. Right? So how are we going to fix the airport? We're going to come back. We're going to talk about that.
FM Talk 106.5 with Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Call 251-343-0106. Here again is your personal nature expert, Bill Finch.
Yeah, so what do we do for the airport to say something about Mobile? It was a very different place, wasn't it, 250 years ago? You may not recognize that. It wasn't, the Delta was a swamp. Rag was a kind of a swamp, but very different. Rag Swamp is where the, and I heard there was a lot of traffic about Rag Swamp last week. Rag Swamp is where the old malls are now, where 65 runs through Mobile. All of that was very different. There were lots of pine savannas everywhere. Pines were probably far more common then in Mobile County. They certainly were more common in Mobile County then than they are now. Isn't that interesting? Live oaks would have been very rare and probably restricted to some beautiful spots along the bay and in areas where there was shellhash, but they wouldn't have been spreading all over the place with the water oaks and all of the other weedy trees that we now have coming in everywhere. It was a very different place. And it's got to be hard to get back to that. It's going to be hard to fit your imagination around that, isn't it? So, but what was it? What was the gardening situation like? Maybe we move forward in the landscapes just a little bit and start thinking about what was it like in the 19th century when Mobile was beginning to prosper a bit as a city. It took a while. It's a pretty miserable little place about 1805, 1806, 1810, and even more miserable before that. But by, I don't know, sometime after New Orleans took off, Mobile finally took off. Sometime around maybe about 1830, 1840, 1850 with the advent of cotton in the interior. And what were the gardens like? We have some pictures and they're really interesting. They're really cool. And people were experimenting in lots of ways. There were still a lot of, I want my garden to look like what my great-great-grandfather's garden looked like in England, right? So there was a good bit of that. You could see it. But there was a lot of experimentation with things that did well here. I will tell you, they didn't have lawnmowers in those days. Have you ever contemplated life without a lawnmower? It's a fun thing to do. It's not a bad thing to do, as a matter of fact. I highly recommend it because we've built our gardening life around lawnmowers, and it's too bad. But they didn't have lawnmowers in the 19th century. They didn't have little push lawnmowers that didn't have a motor. They didn't have any of that. And so you see these beautiful pictures of beautiful gardens and the ladies in long skirts tending to their roses, because roses were very popular, not the roses that you get at Lowdown Depot. Very different types of roses that actually did prosper here along the Gulf Coast, mostly from China, but they were from southern China and were very tough. They weren't the hybrid teas we know now, which can be very finicky. They were pretty tough customers, and they were beautiful, and they made big cabbage-like roses. And there were plenty of azaleas. But also a lot of experimentation with things that we don't think about anymore. Things like palms. And even in the earliest photographs of Mobile, we see palms. I think palms were very much a part of this landscape. There's reports, writings from that period that suggest that, just as a matter of course, that docks, that the pilings for docks were made out of palm trunks. Think about that. And we're talking about 18th century Mobile. Now, you don't maybe don't think about this, but when we bring in palms now, we dig them up somewhere in Central Florida or somewhere, and we cart them over on a truck and plop them down in our yard. People didn't do that in the 18th century. Those palms were already here, and they were big sable palms. They were tall palms, and there was clearly a population of sable palms somewhere around Mobile, not too far. Or it would be hard to understand how they could have been so common that they used them for pilings. One piece of evidence. We also know that there were lots of palms in the Delta, and there still is. Native palms everywhere. What we call the little blue-stem palmetto. Not the tall palmettos, but the little blue-stem palmettos that got about 12 feet tall. Sometimes with a bit of a trunk. They could be up to 6 feet, 7 feet, 8 feet tall, but very common, very abundant, everywhere. And along with the other palms, Serranoa repens, the saw palmetto, which we still see in the very few undeveloped places left along the Gulf Coast, growing native. It's been there all along, saw palmettos, and needle palms were also native here, clearly native here. And they're beautiful palms, great shrub palms, barrel-like palms that you can use around your house. I always feel like in areas where needle palms are native that it is the great welcoming palm. And it was, I think, important to the pre-Columbian people that were here too, that those needle palms were very important and signified a sense of home or a sense of place, because those palms were pretty useful, and we can talk about why they're useful, but palms are everywhere in Mobile long before people got here, and they were here in the 19th century when people began gardening. And so palms, I think if you were going to design a Mobile landscape, palms are very much a part of that landscape, and thank goodness, because palms, particularly in a place like the Gulf Coast, are very easy to work around. And they're also not going to do terrible damage to your house while still providing many of the features, many of the shade features. We can talk about that. We can talk about how to make shade out of palms. And there's some great ways to think about it that you wouldn't have otherwise, because you can't plant trees close to the house without them falling on your house during the hurricane. If a palm is going to be one of the last things standing during a hurricane, I can tell you, because I've seen it over and over again, when live oaks were dug up in Mississippi during Katrina and washed hundreds of yards inland, roots and all, massive live oaks, and piled next to the railroad tracks. And what was left standing were the palms. Amazing. So they're great features, and something that the airport can use, because they're not going to create a lot of interference with the with planes. They're not going to get too tall. So palms would definitely be part of that. What are some of the other things that we had here in the 19th century? Roses are going to be hard for us. I might suggest it. But, you know, one of the things that you saw a lot in the pictures of 19th century Mobile and is vines. And people built structures for vines around their houses. They built structures for vines everywhere. And in places that we now would think about using trees, people would use vines, because vines made a lot more sense in many cases. I think vines were very much a part even of downtown Mobile, as they are now in New Orleans and many places where those balconies can serve as structures for vines. But vines are something that we could use a lot more of. And you know, the cool part is, you know where the center of vine diversity is in North America? Alabama. Amazing. It's just this huge blob when you're looking at the maps of plant concentrations, when you're looking at the maps that the Biodiversity of North America program does, and they're saying, okay, which part of the United States has the greatest number of Vons per this area. And it's clearly Alabama. We'll come back. We'll talk more about it. Vons is what I would recommend at the airport. Palms. What are some of the other things?
All the tea in China. Put it in a big brown bag for me. Sail right round.
Welcome back to Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast with Bill Finch. Ask Bill about gardening and nature in your backyard. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
Yes, so I'm helping you, asking you to help me design fitting symbols, landscape symbols of what Mobile is like, what it's been like in its long history, not what Home Depot says it should be like, but what it was actually like over many centuries, and what makes it distinctive, and what we could see as being distinctive about Mobile in the future. Why would the landscape around the new Mobile airport look the same as the landscape around the airport in Cincinnati, Ohio, or Detroit, Michigan, or why would it look the same? And yet we try to do that over and over again. And we want to say to people, boy, we're different. We're distinctive. So that's what the airport wants to do. And how do we do that? And how do we capture the essence of what Mobile has been over hundreds and thousands of years that makes it so distinctive and so different? And we talked about some of those things. It's going to be really hard for you to imagine that landscape 250 years ago, 300 years ago, 10,000 years ago. Those are fairly recent. I know you don't live very long, so it seems to you that seems like it was a long time ago. But from a landscape perspective, from a forest perspective, that's fairly recent. Only a few generations ago, a forest. What was it like? And B-Dark says, oh, there must have been lots of briars. And you know, B-Dark, here's an interesting thing. I will say this. B-Dark's idea that there would have been a lot more briars in those days, because what we have are lots of briars now. And we have to use a mower to cut them down. Well, as a matter of fact, there probably weren't so many briars. And why wouldn't there have been so many briars? Interesting. Go to Splinter Hill Bog. It's an interesting place. That's what it looked like. And what you'll see, if Splinter Hill survives all the development that occurs around it, and you might want to go quick because I don't know. What you'll see at Splinter Hill Bog is not a landscape with lots of briars, even though nobody mows it. It's a landscape with lots of flowers. It's a landscape that's colored with flowers almost all year long. Unbelievable diversity of wildflowers. There were shrubs, and along some drains, there were some trees and shrubs, and it's a little thicker, and there are a few scattered trees, but only in places where humans make the biggest mess are there briars. Interesting, isn't it? Why is that? Well, it has a lot to do with fire. And fire was very much a part of the landscape, and that changed things. So, no, actually, there probably weren't so many briars. There was, however, in addition to the things we're talking about, the vines, which would have been enormous and rich. And you get a little bit of sense of those vines when you drive across the Dolly Parton Bridge and the causeway going northward, and you can see all those vines climbing the trees, and people think, because they don't really understand where they are, that, gosh, that kudzu is taking over. Well, there's no kudzu there in the Delta. Those are just native vines. This is a place that grows vines very well, and many of those vines will easily smother kudzu. if you create the right conditions for them. We're a great center of vine diversity, and many of those vines are beautiful. They're beautiful bloomers, really incredible. The palms are incredible, and we talked about that, and they're very much a part of our landscape. But what are some other things? Bamboo. And this is hard to imagine. But there are some accounts that indicate that as much as a sixth of Alabama was covered in bamboo when people first came here. I actually think the number might be higher. There are areas that were solid bamboo, almost nothing else except the community types that survived with bamboo, but very few trees, mostly bamboo. There were many other areas where bamboo, where under the widely spaced trees, bamboo would have been very common. Splinter Hill is a great example of it, where you'll see bamboo growing all over that landscape. We don't even know exactly what kind of bamboo that is at Splinter Hill, by the way. And that's native bamboo. We now have four species. We'll probably have six species of bamboo that are native to Alabama. Almost certainly six species before the next few years are out, as people begin to study them better and describe them. We may have more. We're the great center of bamboo diversity in North America. And it's not the bamboos that we imported. Yes, we imported lots of bamboos from China. And fishing pole bamboo is one, the yellow bamboo, the very tall bamboo at Bellingrath. That's imported. That's from China. But we had lots of native bamboo over many parts of Alabama. And some of it was quite large, 20, 25, 30 feet, says Bartram. Maybe taller, particularly around Mobile, some of the largest canes in areas of the Delta. But bamboo is very much a part of our heritage, and we don't think about it. We don't use it. So I said to the airport, you really ought to think about it. It does say something special about Mobile. It's a surprising thing for people to see. And we have clumping bamboos that are very easy to use. Very easy to use. They don't spread. I used them all around my house at Midtown. They're really cool. They're beautiful. And they don't spread. You don't want to use a spreading bamboo if you're in there with a bunch of other folks next to a bunch of houses, because you're not going to be able to control it. But some of the clumping bamboos recall that heritage of bamboo and Mobile. It's always been very important. So I would say, yeah, think about bamboos. Think about bamboo. Wow, isn't that weird to think about that? And I also would remind them, don't think about, when you're thinking about trees, don't just think about live oaks. We've got a problem with live oaks now because they're planted limb to limb to limb. They are actually fairly surprisingly vulnerable to hurricanes. Their dropping limbs can do lots of damage, and it's very hard to garden under them. Nearly impossible. I think they're okay street trees. I think we can use live oaks, and I think we should use other trees with those live oaks. But live oaks were never common. In fact, there's even Andrew Jackson. In Andrew Jackson's day, we have many accounts saying, look, we're having a hard time finding enough live oaks to build ships along the Gulf Coast because they weren't that common. And now we've made them common, and now we're courting disease, we're courting disaster by planting them everywhere. But there are lots of other trees besides live oaks. Oh, let me get there quickly. And pines are one. And we have a huge diversity of pines, and they're beautiful. And things like spruce pine. What a beautiful, stunning tree. What a great tree to use in a landscape. Slash pine would be an incredible tree to use in that landscape. And they're incredibly wind firm. I am always shocked at how well the slash pines do, because they have a very grippy root system that spreads pretty wide. And maybe even for places like the airport, slash pine would be a better pine than longleaf pine, because they do have such a grippy root system and because those soils can tend to be a little wet. So don't avoid those, or don't avoid things like pond cypress, which would be beautiful there. There's many, many selections of trees that would be great for that landscape if we were thinking about it. Hibiscus. everywhere. Every landscape in Mobile that was native had hibiscus. And if you look in the old gardens of Mobile, they always loved hibiscus. They were featured in many cases. Hibiscus. Why don't we use more hibiscus? What a great plant for Mobile. What a great part of our heritage. If you're actually driving over the Mobile Tensaw Delta, you'll see it blooming. In June and into July, you'll see it blooming in the wetlands that we haven't developed in South Baldwin County, everywhere, and in South Mobile County. They're beautiful, hibiscus. These are the kinds of things that we don't think about and should think about when we're thinking about our landscape, along with things like iris, our native wetland iris. Incredible, incredible colors. Incredible range of colors. Even in the wild populations. Unbelievable. Why don't we use them? And lilies of all kinds. These are our tropical lilies. Really great. Really wonderful things to use. These are the kinds of things that I would draw from the old landscapes of Mobile. Vines and palms and bamboo. And hibiscus. And what are the things that we added over time? And how would I use those? Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about that when we come back. Feel free to give us a call and contribute your thoughts about So there was Dave is saying that AI says something different than what I'm saying. Let me tell you about AI. AI depends on the data inputs that you put into it. And it's not smart. And in all likelihood, Alabama is going to beat even Mexico for bamboo diversity. Even maybe the entirety of Mexico for bamboo diversity. There is good bamboo diversity there, but I think maybe when we're through looking at the bamboo diversity in Alabama, it might actually exceed what's in Veracruz. So, one thing to think about, who knows what AI means by native and who knows, but AI is probably not the best and most reliable source here. Just be cautious when you use AI. But yeah, bamboo is very much a part of who we are. And when you say North America, you need to include Mother Mexico. One of the more biologically diverse places on the planet, with incredible diversity, incredible things going on there. And it's very important, but I actually think Alabama may in the end exceed even Mother Mexico for bamboo diversity.
I ain't gonna pick no peas, because everything's gonna funny, you gotta get down on your bending knees. I dig no more taters. I decline, I ain't gonna pick no peas. Because everything is on the phone, you know you got to...
FM Talk 106.5, home for plain living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106.
Hey, welcome back, Gulf Coast. Gardeners, Alabama gardeners. We're talking about landscapes and trying to sort things out because the Mobile Airport was thinking about how do we have a landscape that expresses where we are. And I'm trying to employ you to think about that. We talked about bamboo, and I want to just get into a few things. When you're talking about concentration of bamboo species, I think Alabama will probably, by the time it's all done, may well exceed any place in North America in terms of concentration of species. Its competition would be Mexico, and particularly the southernmost parts of Mexico and the Yucatan, where there are a number of species. Whether those occur with the same intense concentration that they occur in Alabama is an open question. Yes. But I think Alabama will be pretty competitive even with those tropical areas in Mexico. Certainly, it is the greatest concentration of bamboo species in the temperate parts of North America. But it's very important to us, these bamboos, and explaining why Alabama's like it is. In fact, it may even have contributed to the name Alabama. And it certainly contributed to the name Coosa. And many other place names that we see in Alabama, because native bamboo was so usually important. So that would be part of this landscape that we think about. So things to think about as we're thinking about I'm thinking, oh, design the airport, put native food like strawberries, blackberries, summer squash, butter beans on the fence line. You know, Be Dark, that's a great idea. And one of the things I mean, butter beans were such a part. Butter beans are native to the New World. Probably to Central and South America somewhere. But they are very much a part of our heritage here. And they've been part of our heritage here for a long, long time. Almost certainly butter beans were used before Columbus came by native peoples, moved around like corn, and very much a part of our heritage. And I've always thought that if you had a framework like on a parking deck or something, you could actually use butter beans, which is traditionally what people used around their houses until the other vines got established. It would be kind of fun. And there's some ornamental butter beans that would be very attractive, like willow leaf butter beans. And in the old houses around Mobile, Be Dark, you could see how they set up frames for vines. And oftentimes those frames had butter beans growing on them, butter bean shade, as it was called in summer. So that in winter, the vines died back, and you could pick the butter beans as you went. V-Dark was a little worried about the jet fuel, but that jet fuel is probably going to be a problem all over the Midtown neighborhoods as well, if it's a problem around the airport. You can consider that, think about that. I don't know how big of a problem it will be around the airport, but probably not much worse than it'll be around the Midtown neighborhoods next to the airport. Probably no worse than it would be from all the cars driving around all of our neighborhoods. They still have some problems, but in terms of their emissions. So I wouldn't worry too much about that, but I don't think you'll have anybody out there picking the butter beans is part of the problem. And that may be why butter beans is not the best thing, but yeah, I think it's a cool idea to plant butter beans on those fences as kind of a symbol of where we are. Interesting, isn't it? So that's what we've been thinking about. What are some of the other plants? And I just want to sort of lay the groundwork. For thinking about what this landscape would look like, because it might help you with your yard too. One of the big things that came into Mobile that I think were very important, three important things that came into Mobile from other places. Azaleas. And they were hugely important, even maybe back into the early part of the 19th century. And certainly by the end of the 19th century and in the early 20th century, azaleas were a big part of the landscape in Mobile. And we've forgotten about that because we've let Home Depot tell us what kind of azaleas to grow. And we've forgotten those why azaleas were so important to Mobile, because in the early part of the 20th century and up until the mid part of the 20th century, azaleas were spectacular. They weren't something they said. They were just bushes. They were things that people said, oh my goodness, when they bloomed. The azaleas you now get, which are the so-called ever-blooming azaleas that you get from Home Depot, when you plant those, they bloom a little bit, but nobody ever says, oh my goodness. People say, yeah, you got a shrub there. It's got a little bloom on it. You don't even see it. It's not impressive. But those old azaleas, the Southern Indian azaleas, are certainly something we should think about using. They did have nearly perfect shade in the gardens of 19th century Mobile, because in many cases, the gardens weren't covered in live oaks. They were covered in pines. And those pines made a much better canopy for azaleas and camellias and other things than the young live oaks that we plant now, where everything struggles to bloom. But many of those old azaleas, the old Southern Indians, would do great at the airport, even in pretty much full sun. Something like Formosa. Leaves might be a little pale, but it's a pretty tough customer and will survive if it's on the right soils. And give it a little shade. Little shade. Doesn't need much. If you want that foliage to look really good, but it will handle it really well. The big Formosa azaleas. Not every Southern Indian will like that kind of full sun, but Southern Indians will tolerate it. Camellias were the other thing that we brought in during the 19th century. And, you know, by the time I was born and the time I was growing up in Mobile, it was like everybody was having a camellia that they were propagating themselves, developing themselves, breeding themselves, and naming it after themselves if they so desired, or for their wives or for their best friends. And they were everywhere. Camellias were huge. They were a huge part of Mobile. We've kind of forgotten that now. And, you know, it's really funny that only the most boring and camellias are now used in landscapes. We have some great choices. We'll come back. We'll talk about that in the next hour.
Walk along the river. Just keep on flowing, and don't worry about where it's going. Oh, no.
It's time for Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast, with nationally recognized nature writer and award-winning horticulture and nature expert, Bill Finch. Bill shares his knowledge of conservation, natural history, and gardening. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with your personal garden and nature consultant. Here's Bill Finch on FM Talk 106.5.
Okay, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning and Alabama Sunday morning. We're talking about what it is like, what a landscape would be like in Alabama if it really reflected Alabama's history, if it really reflected Alabama's original landscape. And it's very different. It's a very different discussion in different parts of the state. And somebody should ask me to talk about some of the other parts, like Huntsville or Birmingham or Montgomery. It would be a lot of fun. I have focused today on the area along the Gulf Coast, because the Mobile Airport Authority asked me to think about it, and I'm asking you to think about it, because some of the struggles that they'll have creating a landscape that really conveys what Mobile is like are going to be some of the same struggles you have in your garden. because we're not used to using, I mean, we're just not even used to thinking about the kinds of plants that would grow really well here, because most of what we read about gardening comes from other places, or it's determined by what somebody at Home Depot or Lowe's decides what we should be planting in our yards. Kind of a shame. But we talked a lot about vines. We talked about palms and how big they were, how much a part they were of this landscape. We talked about bamboo, and we're going to say Alabama is likely the center of bamboo diversity north of Central America and the Yucatan Peninsula, which is in the border of Central America. But it is clearly the center of bamboo diversity in the United States. And it's a great part of our heritage. And even though it may be difficult to use some of those bamboos here, it's fun to think about how we can use bamboos that are clumpers that don't spread too widely, that just can be contained in a very small area naturally, how they can sort of help us build gardens that better reflect the kind of climate and the kind of place we have. I love bamboos because they create really important shade in some great areas, and they're perfect for screens, and they're virtually immune to hurricanes. I mean, you might get some canes blown down, but you know what? You use the canes to put your tomatoes on, and they're going to grow back from the base. So they're really good that way. They're great things to use. And then we talked about azaleas, which I would love to talk about more, and you should feel free to call me. And we talked about camellias, and B. Dark said, and this is an important part of the camellia story, camellias were always a part of Mobile. And B. Dark said, is it true that you can make tea out of camellias? And yes, it's true, but only certain kinds of camellias will make good tea. There's a story, and it may be true. I'll pass it along. I think it needs more research. And I think Mr. Dodd passed one of these articles along that suggested that some of the camellias may have come to Mobile and to the South very early, in part because, and to Europe very early, because everybody was trying to grow tea. And some of the camellias that China didn't really want to give up the market on tea. And the story was, which may be true, but just to give you a sense of how closely related they are, China said the Chinese didn't want to give away the secrets to making tea to the Europeans. They didn't want to lose that market. When the Europeans asked for tea for their plantations in India and other places, they were given camellias, flowering camellias, because the words were very similar, and maybe it was, oh, sorry about that. And so flowering camellias came instead of the tea plants. But tea plants, Camellia sinensis, are very similar to the camellias that we now use for flowers. Camellia japonica, Camellia sasanqua. Other types of camellias that we use for flowers are all very closely related to Camellia sinensis, the plant that produces tea. And B. Dark, I should tell you that Lipton, Camellia sinensis grows so well here that Lipton tea, you remember Lipton? When, before Nixon went to China and opened up China trade, Lipton was very concerned that we wouldn't be able to get tea anymore from communist China. And so they created their own tea plantations in places like Baldwin County. And so the area east of Fairhope, was a huge tea plantation created by Lipton, and was for many years. Some of those old tea plants are still there. It wasn't successful commercially, for a lot of reasons. But tea plants did very well. And I had some of those tea plants in my yard in Mobile for many years. And they did very well. And I still think there's a great opportunity for creating tea plantations here in Alabama, if not immediately along the Gulf Coast, a little farther inland. And it's a great opportunity. Probably makes a lot more sense than cotton, certainly makes more sense than things like olive oil. We could grow tea plants or tea plant relatives that actually produce oils that are great for cooking. Just a hint at how important camellias are. We actually had our own camellia relatives here. And they're now very rare. One of them still grows along a few blackwater sloughs in Baldwin County, maybe in Mobile County too. Really a beautiful tea-like flower on some of those trees. And so it's very much, I think camellias are very much a part of our heritage. Can we use those at the airport? Yeah, probably. Some of the varieties that are more sun tolerant can be used. And Bobby Green has certainly worked on some of those and demonstrated that they can be sun tolerant. And I encourage the airport landscape group to go to Bobby Green and talk to him, because Bobby's the expert. He's created camellias for years in Fairhope. His nursery is no longer open, but he is still the expert, and he's been awarded many times by the Camellia Society for the work he's done on camellias. And he's got some great ones that would be great. So all of these things are part of our heritage. You know, what one of the old landscape plans they had there was, just had some kind of viburnum. And it's a Home Depot viburnum. And I said, why wouldn't you put things like camellias there? Why wouldn't you put things like tea plants, which have this beautiful fragrance? And even though they're not native, they're very much a part. Tea olive plants, excuse me. They're very much a part of our heritage. Why wouldn't we use those instead of just what we get off the shelf at Home Depot? Thinking about that landscape. How do you do it? We have a wise guy saying we need to stock lover grasshoppers at the airport. Imagine someone from New York walking out to get their rental car and seeing a horde of 4-inch lovers. Yes, if you've never seen a lover, you'll think that they're wind-up toys. They're so big. They're like big metal wind-up toys. I remember some of the first times I saw them when I was very young and thought, gosh, what kind of toy is that? They're amazing.
Get Plain Talk on Plain Living. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. Jim in Georgetown says, we've got 4 or 5 of those sinensis camellias that I need to get into the ground. All other camellias here do not get full sun and they thrive. Do the tea plants like partial to full dappled shade? You know, tea plants can be pretty tough. I wouldn't worry too much about them. If you're growing them on a tea plantation, you're not growing them in shade. You're actually growing them out in a field. I would not worry so much about it, Jim. But a little bit of shade might help them look a little better. You want them to get as much sun. You know, midday sun is not important. What's important is that morning sun. You want them to get as much morning sun as they possibly can get, up to about 11 o'clock. And then a lot of sun, if possible, late in the day as well can be really important. A little bit of shade at midday may actually be beneficial. But Camellia sinensis wants a lot of sun. There was some old Camellia sinensis that Martin and I found around an old home site that was being turned into a grocery store on the hill above, gosh, what was that? It was on Old Shell going out back up the hill and behind a grocery store, and it was in full sun, been there for years and years, doing well, spreading, as a matter of fact. So they're pretty tough customers, those Camellia sinensis. And I assume most of those were propagated from the Camellia sinensis, the tea plants, true tea plants, that were part of the Lipton plantation. Many of them were. Wayne said he got some sweet gums and planted, and he thought that they might be part of the landscape too, and indeed they were. Sweet gums are native in Mobile County and Baldwin County. Don't ask a forester if they're native or they'll roll their eyes, because sweet gums come in when you cut a forest like a thicket. They can be very prolific. And which is, I like sweet gums. I think they're really neat. I think that they can be a little difficult to deal with, particularly if you're not using fire in the landscape. I think sweet gums are more common now, much more common in Mobile and Mullen County than they used to be, in part because we've suppressed fires. But they've always been native here. They've always been native here. I also overlooked a question that Wayne sent me a while back, about a bed, and I think he sent me the picture a couple of weeks ago, 2 or 3 weeks ago, where he's got Kogon grass in a bed with monkey grass and several shrubs. And that's going to be a difficult one. If you want to call and talk about that, I mean, I think that bed can be salvaged, but you're going to have to, it's going to be work. There's no question. And you're going to have to keep that, you're going to have to keep the Kogon grass from coming in around it, from the grass, because it's in that grass adjacent. And there's some, probably some ways of doing that. And let's talk about it. Let's talk about it. So Kogon grass is going to travel a long distance. And it's going to reinfest beds if you're not careful. But Kogon grass hates shade. It needs sunlight. It needs abundant sunlight. And there are several ways of dealing with that. And one is to mow it fairly closely. Now, if you've got, and that means next to your beds, I would definitely consider with Bermuda grass or Kogon grass, mowing that grass as tight as possible. As tight as possible in a band around your beds. And there really is just no other good way of doing it. And that's what I do. This is why many people lose their grass, because they cut the lawn too short. I do it deliberately when I don't want lawn to grow. And so I put my mower on 1 inch and I mow the area where the Bermuda grass and the Kogon grass is. And I keep mowing it at that height, for as long as I can in a band around those beds. It helps a lot with Bermuda grass. Sometimes I'll come back with a string trimmer as well to keep that band there. It probably will help with Kogon grass as well. You might have to make the band a little bit wider. But you see what I'm saying about you could weed that bed out of Kogon grass. Kogon grass, folks, is a really weedy grass. It's really tough. It's really bad. It's a disaster we brought on ourselves, like fire ants. And you may be upset that I can't tell you how to get rid of fire ants. I can tell you how to control them, but I can't tell you how to get rid of them. And Kogan is even worse. It's a real problem for gardening, and it is, I can't fix the fact that we brought in one of the most invasive plants in the world and planted it deliberately. It was just, heaven help us. But we did. But you can create those bands. I would say, I do think you can clean out that bed really well, but you're probably going to have to take the monkey grass out and separate the monkey grass from the Kogan grass, because it's going to be very hard to maintain both of those in the same place. Now, you can mow that monkey grass. I'm not sure you could in that spot. It doesn't look like it's going to be easy because it looks like kind of a hump. You can mow the monkey grass, and don't mow it that short, and that will control the Kogan grass, because the Kogan grass is not going to get enough sunlight. And I'd mow the monkey grass about 4 inches tall. Be fine. And I think that the Kogan grass will suffer as a consequence, whereas the monkey grass won't. It'll do just fine. Don't need to mow the monkey grass too frequently. I don't know. Probably 4 times a year. But certainly any time that the Kogan grass emerges, you see the Kogan grass coming out, go ahead and mow the monkey grass again. Set it as high as you need to. 4 inches is probably great. 5 inches. And mow it just to control the Kogan grass. And the monkey grass will be more shade tolerant, and more sun tolerant. And it will take to, let me just say, it's going to be more shade tolerant. It will survive that mowing, whereas the Kogan grass won't. So there's one way to think about it. You can create a band there, a wide band with the monkey grass around your beds that may make it difficult for the Kogan grass to penetrate to where your flowering plants are. Does that make sense? Call me if it doesn't. We'll talk about how to do it in more detail. Let's see what else we got. Jim in Georgetown. So, Jim, this is the classic question. My mother does this every year, and Jim, you're not my mother. You don't want to be my mother. I love my mother. I don't want you to be my mother. but you have the same reaction my mother does. My mother calls me every May and June, sometime in June, and it's like, Bill, what's happened to the hummingbirds? They've all disappeared. Is it Alabama Power? Seriously. You can blame Alabama Power for lots of things, but not for the hummingbirds. What happened to the hummingbirds? So here's the thing. Jim says, gosh, I thought the hummingbirds were gone for the summer, and suddenly they're reappearing on my wife's porterweed. Jim, are you going to, don't get mad at me for doing this, Jim. It's such a good opportunity. So they're back, and it happens every year. Watch it. It happens every year. The hummingbirds, sometime around April in Mobile, sometimes in late April, early May, they just disappear. But they come back. Let's talk about it when we get back ourselves. Have you ever?
You get Plain Talk on Plain Living. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
All right. Bucky Beaver says, I love you, man, but you're wrong. I don't like sweet gums. And that's fair. If you're walking barefoot, sweet gum balls are a bit of a nuisance. And that's one of the things that happens if you plant sweet gum in your yard. I love the color. The color is great. I love to see it. It's just the most weird and fantastic of all of the fall color trees, because so many colors are wrapped up in a sweet gum. And so for that reason, I have a special fondness for it, I guess, because it reminds me of paintings that were part of my childhood of sweet gums. But yes, they do leave sweet gum balls. Bucky Beaver also asked me, because we've been talking a lot about bamboos, about something his granddaddy called Calcutta cane, which is an interesting term, and I guess you probably hear that occasionally. I think Calcutta cane, technically, if there is a technicalness to common words, is Dendrocalamus, which is a bamboo that is native to Asia and the tropical parts of Asia, and it's one of the bamboos used to make certain types of fishing poles. They're particularly sturdy. We can't grow it here. It's not hardy here. But there are other bamboos that would have resembled that were big canes, and it would have gotten the name Calcutta cane just because that's, you know, anybody can use a common name any way they want to. And it was Calcutta cane was a name that was used in the trade for certain types of bamboos. And it came to be centered on a certain type of big bamboo grown in the South, I expect. But it's probably that bamboo that your granddaddy remembered in Georgia was probably not true Calcutta cane, but some kind of Phyllostachys cane from China or Japan that was a more temperate bamboo. And they can get quite large, like the bamboos at Bellingrath, for example, like the bamboos in Birmingham. At the Birmingham Botanical Gardens, for those of you in North Alabama who've seen those, something that I remember. Those are all spreading bamboos. Most of those are spreading bamboos, and they can be very difficult to manage. There are clumping bamboos that I will stress that only grow in a small circle, and they can be easily managed and mowed around. They're not a problem to manage at all, and I encourage people to think about it for their gardens, because they're such a good solution. They're so much better solution than the junk that you get at Lowdown Depot for screens and other things that are not going to survive, that cause all kind of problems, that take up way too much space ultimately, and that lose their lower limbs. All these things you won't have that problem with these bamboos. And that's what's really great. If you are wondering about whether to use a bamboo, give me a call. We'll talk about how to use it and where to use it. They're a great solution. I'm suggesting it to the airport. I think it's a great idea. I don't know whether they'll use it, but it's fun to think about these things. And that's what we've been thinking about, the kinds of plants that are native here or that have a long gardening history here. Citrus is one that we haven't gotten to that clearly has a long history here, and one that we probably don't think of using ornamentally, but in fact are great. And I do think that the landscaping group may actually use kumquats. And if they do, maybe that will be a great lesson to many of you, that kumquats are actually great plants to use here along the Gulf Coast. Ornamentally, think about an evergreen that has beautiful fragrant flowers in spring, and then is covered in orange fruits for much of the fall and into the winter. And you don't even have to pick the fruits. They're just beautiful. It's just like decorated. But if you decide to pick them, pick them. And they make nice little shrubs, kumquats, great things. They'll probably use those. So these are part of our heritage. Grasses are part of our heritage too. And I'm going to talk to them a little bit more about grasses. And when we think of grasses, we think about something that we mow with some frequency. And as I said, for thousands of years, people in Mobile did not have lawnmowers. And they manage grasses in different ways. And they did not expect grasses to be less than ankle high. And the pictures, the great, I love the pictures of ladies with their lawn skirts with their roses in the great gardens of Mobile of the 19th and early 20th century with grass, beautiful broom sage grasses standing up about shin high in their gardens. And they accepted that. That was normal. That was the way, of course it was. And much of the year you could walk on those grasses, but in fall they would get a little tall, they'd flower. You could then take a scythe and knock them back, but you didn't mow them all the time like we do now. And there were some great, beautiful grasses, and there still are great, beautiful grasses. I'm trying to think of which ones I'm going to encourage them to use the most. They're certainly going to use Muhlenbergia, which is something people use now a lot. It's that pink muley that people use. They'll probably use a muley that is not native to Alabama. They'll probably use one from the South Carolina coast. And I probably won't even have a chance to stop it, but I'll mention it. That it would be great to get populations that are native here that will probably perform a little better and that won't create a genetic and weedy problem for us. But they'll probably use pink muley, but there's other things like toothache grass, which is a beautiful native grass that I think we have some great opportunities to use. And split-beard blue stems, which are beautiful, beautiful grasses in the landscape. I mean, they're ornamental grasses. They're not walking on grasses that much. They're ornamental grasses. But the fact of the matter is you got a lot of driving going on at the airport and not much walking around. And most people don't even walk in their yards. This is what's so weird and absurd. They rarely even walk on the grass, and yet they mow it all the time. If you're not going to walk on it, why are you mowing it? It's my thing. If you're not going to wrestle your brother on it, why are you mowing it? See what I'm saying? No, you don't see what I'm saying, because we're so addicted to mowing. But I'll just say, if you're not going to walk on it, if you're not going to wrestle your brother on it or your sister, why would you mow it? Just a really interesting question. So they're going to use some of those grasses in the landscape. All right. I didn't finish the conversation about the hummingbirds. Listen, here's the thing about hummingbirds. They leave every year in April and May. They come back in July on the Gulf Coast, and then they stay. Where do they go? Well, they're probably nesting, and they're probably staying very close to their nesting habitats, which are generally not in people's yards. I think, as it turns out, I think they go to the woods for that. And so I think people don't see them very often. Are they still using plants? Probably. But they're probably in more remote areas away from houses. And then they'll come back into the open areas. They're probably breeding. They're probably nesting in the thickets. You see what I'm saying? And then they're coming back into people's yards after they've fledged the young generation. And that's when you see them come back. Happens every year. Can I put my 1 foot tall tomatoes in the ground now, says B Dark? Sure. Absolutely. No problem. They're going to grow well. You could hold on to them a little longer, but I think I'd go ahead and get them well established. Just make sure it's in good ground. And give them a chance to grow up. I think you'll be just fine, B Dark. Is Bill the only thing South Baldwin is growing? B Dark says, is subdivisions. Yep. Jim and Georgetown, red bell pepper. Nope. This is an almost ripe Bota. Botan koshu chili pepper. Super sweet and a touch of heat. Bet this will make an excellent sauce. So I'm going to have to try this Botan kosha chili pepper, Jim, since on your recommendation. It looks beautiful. Looks nice. Looks like something to try. If Jim is actually typing this in and not using voice recognition, It's spelled BOTANKOSHU. Is that correct, Jim? BOTANKOSHU. I'm not familiar with it, and I'll have to try it. What type of caterpillar is this? It's on a tobacco plant, George in Pascagoula. Oh, boy. So there are tomato hornworms. There are tobacco hornworms. It's sometimes hard to tell the difference. I remembered how to tell the difference at one point, and I have to look it up every year. That should tell you something about tomato hornworms and tobacco hornworms. They're very closely related. And that's what you got. And tobacco hornworms will actually get onto tomato plants as well. They do kind of cross that way, and I've seen both. But there it is. They will eat your, they'll eat your tobacco plants, down to the ground, just as they will eat your tomato plants down to the ground. And it reminds me that I need to go out with my black light this evening, which I will do. And I will look for hornworms on my tomatoes because it's the time. I'll also look for them on my peppers because it's the time, and they can do real damage. Yeah. So Jim is telling me, no, I don't use that voice stuff. Come on. I'm 60 for crying out loud. So there it is. So it's interesting. So we're going to try the Botan Koshu pepper and see how that works. Let's see. Someone said to amen to B-Dark about South Baldwin growing suburbs.
My girl, don't lie.
FM Talk 106.5 with Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Call 251-343-0106. Here again is your personal nature expert, Bill Finch.
All right, to clarify, Jim does not use voice. Jim in Georgetown does not use voice recognition. He types things out, and sometimes he gets one letter wrong. The pepper is Botan Koshu, according to Baker Creek, which is where he got it. It's a very interesting looking pepper. BOTANKOSHO. And because Jim has grown it so successfully, I'm going to research it more and I'm going to try it myself. Looks interesting, Jim. Looks interesting. I bet it'll be a little hotter here than it is in other places, but could still be a very good and useful pepper. It looks good. Looks great. So we've been talking about creating this landscape for the Mobile Airport. I asked for your help. I got a little bit. I hope that going through that exercise with the Mobile Airport helped you to think about your yard a little better too. We have a long gardening history here in Mobile. It's very distinctive. We've nearly forgotten it because we've let Home Lowdown Depot decide what it is we're going to plant. And we have a very long, much longer than most of the United States, natural history that goes back much older than the history, for example, of the landscape around Asheville, North Carolina, certainly older than New England, which was under a glacier 18,000 years ago when Alabama was still had thriving forests. So we have a lot of things to pull from, a lot of ways to think about it. And what I'm just trying to encourage you to think more about your landscape and what could be distinctive here, just as I'm hoping the airport will be able to think more distinctively about that landscape. If you're going to put an airport there, at least think about how do we remind people what Mobile was like? What it could be again, maybe someday, if we think about it. And so there it is. But we now need to talk briefly before we lose our time about what Bedark has been killing in her garden. What she's been killing in her garden are hornworms. They're on her tomatoes. They are the worms that are fat and green and big and have little, generally have little white racing stripes down the sides. They can be tobacco hornworms. They can be, well, in fact, there's several types of hornworms that you'll see showing up on your tomatoes. And they're all hawk moth worms, different species of hawk moths, and they can all do a little bit of damage to various types of things in your yard. The big thing that's going to be an impact right now is your tomatoes, your peppers, maybe your eggplants as well. And they can really do a number. Even, I mean, I don't think people don't expect it to happen to their peppers, but it happens to the peppers. And boy, is that upsetting. So if one comes up and attacks Jim's Botan, I have to look at Botan Kosho pepper, he's going to be really upset. So be looking for those hornworms now. And they're huge. You're going to be shocked when you see them. You can catch them when they're small, but oftentimes people don't. Look for the poop. I always say look for the poop. Look for the damaged leaves. Look for places that look chewed, and then look below for the green poop, and look right above where that poop is, and you're going to find the hornworm. And he's going to be so big it's going to shock you. And don't go get a spray. Don't get a spray. Just take something and get a pair of pliers and grab him and pull him off. If you can't do it with your hands, just pull him off your hands. It's not going to bite you. Just pull him off and stomp him. It's the most effective way to deal with the hornworms. Now, I'll tell you another little secret. If you can get a black light and go out in the evenings at dusk, you're going to see they glow in the dark. They're very photoluminescent. And you can actually see them on the plants very easily at dusk and at night with a black light. And I have a little black light flashlight that I use for many things, but one of them is to find hornworms with. Boom. So I encourage you to start thinking about that. Take yourself a pair of pliers if you've got, you know, if you're a person who has a gooey allergy. They're fine. And otherwise, just pull them off, throw them on the ground. They're too big to kill with an insecticide at this point. You can spray an insecticide all over your plant, ruin your tomatoes, ruin your brain, ruin your grandchildren, but you could just knock them off, pull them off with a pair of pliers, pull them off with your fingers, whatever works for you, and stomp them. And it is hugely effective. And use the black light. It's really a great and easy way of doing that. Jim in Irvington says, I went through a period of night shifts and was sleeping. Thank you for all the help over the years. Great show. As always, you're a Mobile treasure. Thank you again, John in Irvington. Yeah. Pliers or not, they still pop, Bill. Yes, they do. Jim, meaning they're gooey. Yes, they are gooey. If they're gooey under your shoe, you won't notice. So hornworms, and Jim says, hornworms got one of our jalapenos and the basil. Was surprised by the basil. Yeah, I am too. That's interesting. I think that was probably not going to end up being an extremely healthy hornworm. But they'll eat what they need to. I've had other worms eating my, I've never had the hornworm. That's interesting. Never seen that on basil. But that is interesting. They will eat any pepper. They will eat any tomato. And this is the time of year you're going to see a lot of them. Generally, the good thing about hornworms is that you don't see with tomato worms and other things, which I guess we'll have to talk about because fruits are developing and maybe some of you have had the problem. The hornworms mostly don't eat the fruit first. They eat the leaves first. And there's usually only one of them in a certain area. There may be several on a bush, but usually only one in each area. They're not really abundant like the tomato fruit worms are. So they're easy to catch. And then Clay in Birmingham reminds everyone that he's discovered the 8x10 organza bags at Amazon, great for Bonnie's original tomato, which bears in clusters. Also, I've discovered that using bags from previous seasons are too brittle and stink bugs can penetrate and ruin the fruit. So that's interesting that the organza bags didn't protect. I think what Clay is saying, they didn't protect in the second year from stink bugs. In the second year, but the organza bags are useful for covering tomatoes. The other way to deal with the stink bugs is, of course, to have a prolific, and with the hornworm, is to have, and with the tomato worms, is to have a prolific tomato that produces lots of fruit. All right. We'll be back next week.